All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of the Big Questions with Big John. I am your host, Big John. And today we have a super interesting guest, someone that I've admired from afar for a very long time. Give me one moment. I want to make sure I introduce him properly. My guest today is a prominent American legal scholar and libertarian. He's the author of a dozen books, including A Life for Liberty, The Making of an American Originalist, which was released earlier this year. He has also argued cases in front of the Supreme Court and has taught at several prestigious universities, including Penn, Northwestern, and Harvard Law School. He currently serves as the Patrick Hotung Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown University Law Center, and is the director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution. Everyone, please welcome Professor Randy Barnett. Professor Barnett, how are you today?
I'm good, Big John. How are you doing?
I am fine, sir, and thank you for taking the time to join us today. I know you're a busy man. Really appreciate it. Let's start out kind of at the beginning, and I want to morph into your career. So originally, you're a Midwestern boy. You were born in Chicago. Is that correct?
I was born in Michael Reese Hospital in the city of Chicago. That building doesn't exist anymore. I just saw something online that they want to build they're proposing to build a Bears stadium where on my birthplace, sort of commemorate where I was born by having the Chicago Bears play there. Maybe that will happen.
So I take it you're a long-suffering Bears fan.
I am indeed, but hope springs eternal. We're having another great off season. Now we just have to connect an on season up with our off season, and everything will be great.
I hear you, sir. I'm a born and bred New York Giants fan, so I understand the pain.
Poor you. Well, you could be a Jets fan.
Even worse, right? Yeah. Absolutely, yes. Okay, so you were born in Chicago, I believe, in 1952. So you're really just like in the center of the greatest generation, the Boomers. What was it like growing up in the Midwest at that point? As a contrast, I'm a born and raised New Yorker, and I've come to realize when I interview folks who are not from New York or Boston, the upbringings, although we share an American experience, sometimes they could be a little bit different in the way we've experienced life. So how was it for you growing up, in the late 50s, early 60s in that area in Illinois?
Well, I grew up in a distinctive place called Calumet City, Illinois, which is a suburb south of Chicago. This is my book, A Life for Liberty, The Making of an American Originalist, which you mentioned in the intro. It tells my life story. It tells about the litigation I was involved in. It tells how I became a libertarian, also how I became an originalist. But one of the characters in this book is Calumet City, which is this town I grew up in. It was a great town to be from. It was very, very formative. It was a working class town, bedroom community for people who worked in the mills and the refineries of East Chicago and Hammond, Indiana, because we were right on the border between Illinois and Indiana. It was kind of a tough town at various parts, so you had to be a little tough to grow up there. At least in my case, you had to try to avoid fights wherever possible. Although the book tells a few that came to me that I wasn't able to avoid in high school. I was considered a star student. I probably wasn't as good a student as everybody thought I was, but I was clearly on the intellectual side, and my teachers liked me. So it was a very interesting place to grow up. The other thing that was important about it is that it was a working class democratic town, predominantly Polish Catholic, and there was a considerable amount of anti-Semitism there. I was Jewish, but there were very, very few Jews that lived in Calumet City. In my graduating class of 400, there were four Jews. We went to synagogue. I had to go to synagogue across the state line in Hammond, and in Hammond is where Hammond or Munster was where the Jews lived, but they were tended to be kind of progressive. I was a conservative Republican in those days. When I was 12 years old, I stood up in front of my entire junior high school and grade school student body and debated on behalf of Barry Goldwater. So I was a conservative Republican kid in a predominantly Polish Catholic town. I was a conservative Republican Jewish kid in a predominantly Polish Catholic town going to synagogue with a bunch of progressive or what we would call liberal Jews who didn't like my politics and believed that I came from the wrong side of the tracks because Calumet City was very, very D-class A. All of this was actually very productive because, as Murray Rothbard once told me, The people who are our intellectuals tend to be people who are not 100% part of the culture in which they grew up. And because they're not 100% part of the culture in which they grew up, they kind of objectify the culture. They can see the culture. They sort of step outside a bit and are critical of the culture. And that's the skill that makes for a good academic, a good scholar, a good writer. And I've benefited from that experience ever since.
Yeah. And as you were relating your experience there growing up, and thank you for relating that, you were kind of reminding me of my own sort of past. And I have to tell you, I was a conservative Republican growing up in a Democratic place, the Bronx in New York, which was also like a tough area of New York. And I also had the experience as a child, a generation apart, having to get up in class in the second or third grade, having to defend Richard Nixon. You had to, I would have rather defend Goldwater, but similar type of experience. Let me ask you this. You mentioned And it also clicked to me, by the way, as an aside.
John, you might be surprised to hear many, many people who have read this book have communicated with me on X or elsewhere about how it resonates with them about their own childhood, which makes me think that many of the people who share my politics and my outlook have a tendency to share a lot of my personal history as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting sort of connection there, because it's not – you wouldn't think it was necessarily the case. But also in my travels and in interviewing folks, such esteemed people like yourself, I do get that sense of connection. So that did resonate. Also, the movie The Blues Brothers also made mention of Calumet City several times. So
yes, Jake and Elwood are from Calumet City, and they're one of our proudest products.
Yes.
They also, at least Jake was in Stateville Penitentiary, where I put people when I was a criminal prosecutor in Chicago. So we have that connect. We have that in common as well.
Yes. And before we get to your career as a prosecutor, which I do want to get into, a quick question. You mentioned sort of in passing the anti-Semitism that was in your environment growing up. Did you notice it, as you said, objectively? Like, say, I could see we're being treated differently here, or what? Did you have more direct experiences of anti-Semitic behavior towards you or your family growing up?
Well, the book tells the story about how I was in the second when I was in the second grade on the playground. A classmate of mine, I believe his name was Johnny Campbell, called me a dirty Jew. And so I hauled off and hit him, and we got into a fist fight on the playground. We both were punished for this. And so that was my first introduction to that. Now, years later, writing the memoir, thinking back, it occurred to me that it's quite possible that Johnny Campbell didn't even know I was Jewish. Barnett is not a Jewish name. I didn't look Jewish. It might have just been an insult that he hurled, that he heard at home and he hurled at anybody he cared to insult. I didn't take it that way at the time, but that was my introduction to it. And there were other pieces of evidence that support this. But as you say, it mostly was in co-ed. And I have to stress, I had a very successful childhood. I was president of student council. I was on the carnival court. I was voted most likely to succeed by my classmates. It was not a virulently anti-Semitic place by any means, but it did make me grow up realizing that Jews were a minority. And there was anti-Semitism in existence against them. If you grow up in a place like Scarsdale or Skokie or one of those places where Jews are, have a strong presence, I think it gives you an unrealistic vision of what the state of Jewry is both in the United States and worldwide. And I believe that that has been brought home, into great effect over the last year, ever since October 7th.
I agree with you. And that was going to be my follow-up question. Do you feel upon reflection, not at the time, not contemporarily, but upon reflection, that you were do you consider yourself fortunate that you were raised in a progressive town like Chicago, New York, L.A., where there might be anti-Semitism, but certainly not to the degree that might have existed in other places, especially in the U.S. in the 50s? Do you consider yourself fortunate that was the case, or in some way did that mitigate the severity of it?
I mean, I grew up in Calumet City. I didn't grow up in Chicago. My parents had a my dad had a business in on the south side of Chicago. My grandparents lived in Chicago, so I went to Chicago, but I didn't grow up there. I didn't know much about, you know, the culture there. My culture was Calumet City and Hammond. I mean, it was the Northwest Indiana. We were part of culturally part of Northwest Indiana, called the region. And so that's where I grew up, and it was very insular to the point where, John, when I got my SAT scores and my guidance counselor met with me and about them in high school and told me that with my scores, I could get into Northwestern, which, as you know, is in Evanston, Illinois, on the north side of Chicago. I said, oh, really? Where's that? Northwestern, so far as I was aware of, might have been in Oregon or the state of Washington. It was in the northwest of United States. So that's how insular my upbringing was in Calumet City. And so whatever I experienced, it was distinctive to that culture. And as I say, it was, you know, half, you know, there was a bad side of town and a good side of town, and there were fights, and there were, you know, a lot of guys wearing leather jackets.
Right.
And we had a big mix, but it was a great place to grow up. I mean, the other thing I talk about in the book is how formative it was that there was a grade school band that I became a part of in the second grade. I started playing clarinet, and it was a nationally prominent competitive grade school band. We won the Wisconsin Spectacle of Music. We played at Madison Square Gardens. We played at the New York World's Fair of 1964. Wow. That was as formative in my upbringing, being in the discipline of a band that rehearsed every day and rehearsed all summer, and was extremely successful. We were very cocky, very arrogant about our abilities. If you go on YouTube and you Google. Or go on YouTube and you search for Hoover Schrum Grade School Band, you'll be able to hear the recordings that we made, and you will not believe this was made by a grade school band. So again, but the band director, Mike Landis, this innovative guy, he was a Jewish guy from the south side of Chicago who became a teacher after World War II, after he served in the Army. And he was a very, very liberal, very progressive guy. And so I had a very conservative father who would argue politics with me. And I had this very conservative mentor, Mike Landis, who would argue politics with me. And so that fed my political interest from both sides. But again, it was all fantastic. It was all great. Right. Notwithstanding the fact that I always felt like I didn't quite belong.
Interesting. Okay. So you're coming out of that environment, as you mentioned. I believe in 1974, you had gotten into Northwestern, as you mentioned, and graduated in 1974 with a degree in philosophy, which is interesting, right? And then you went on to Harvard Law School, and you got your law degree there in 1977. Now, for our viewers who are a bit young to have not lived through the 70s, this was, you know, at the tail end of the 60s through the mid-70s, very tumultuous time politically in American history. I would dare say that as a conservative, let me back up half a step. During this period of time, you're in academia, you become a lawyer. It's the mid-70s. We're in the middle of the Nixon administration. What's your political thought process at that stage of your life? Are you still a conservative? Did you start to challenge conservatism with libertarianism at that point? Also, the LP, I believe, was formed in 1972, right? So they're brand new politically as a party. Talk to me a little bit about your political state of mind and your political philosophy at this time in your career.
Yeah, John Hospers was the presidential candidate in 72. He's a philosophy professor from USC. Roger McBride was the presidential candidate in 1976. He was a former Republican elector that voted for John Hospers. He was a renegade elector from Virginia who voted for John Hospers. I became a libertarian in college. The first thing, when I got to college, I was a political science major because I liked politics. I didn't know until I got to Northwestern that political science was not about political theory. It was about empirical opinion research, and, you know, it was all empirical stuff, which was completely tedious. Luckily, Northwestern was on the quarter system, so I was able to take a philosophy course during the winter quarter, and I never knew what philosophy was. I grew up in Calumet City. We didn't know what philosophy was. I never heard of it before. My interest since I was 10 years old was in justice. The reason I wanted to be a lawyer from the age of 10 is because of a TV show that came on television in 62 called The Defenders, which was very obscure because it hasn't been in reruns, but it was a very gritty, realistic, filmed on location in New York about a father-son criminal defense team in Manhattan who represented guilty people as well as innocent people. And when that show came on, I said, that's what I want to be. Perry Mason was already on TV. That didn't do anything for me. That was about solving murders. Being the defenders was about being a lawyer trying to achieve justice. And justice has been the animating theme throughout my life. What I didn't know when I got to college is there's actually a discipline that studies what justice is, and it's called philosophy. When I discovered philosophy my second quarter, by my third quarter, I became a philosophy major, came under the influence of a man named Henry Veach, V-E-A-T-C-H, who wrote the book Rational Man, among other books, and became an Aristotelian Thomist under his influence. Now, that means I became a natural law adherent. And then after that, a classmate of mine, who was also an active conservative Republican, Young Americans for Freedom, told me about this libertarianism stuff that she'd been hearing about as Young Americans for Freedom. And I told her I didn't want to hear anything about it because the name libertarianism sounded weird to me. That was the level at which I was operating. Because the name sounded weird, don't tell me about it. But she invited a junior professor at Northwestern named John Cody to the residential college we lived in, and he gave a talk on libertarianism. And I'm listening to this talk, and I'm thinking, wow, that's rational conservatism. That's a philosophy. Conservatism didn't have a theory, and it still doesn't have a theory, by the way. You ask, who is the politically conservative theorist that you want to read to figure out what conservatism is? There is no such person. Maybe most people will say Russell Kirk, who wrote in the 50s and the 60s. That's not a theory. That's not a theorist that we know of today. At any rate, I thought this guy was telling me was a rational conservatism. And after about 9 months of debating with him, I realized it wasn't really conservatism. It was something else. It was libertarianism. And then I was a libertarian. And by my senior year at Northwestern, I taught an accredited student organized seminar on libertarianism to my classmates at the residential college for credit. So by the time I went to law school, I was already a libertarian. And it was when I first got to law school, I went down to New York with a classmate of mine, and I met Murray Rothbard and all the other New Yorker libertarians. And by the middle of my first year, I had joined the board of directors of the Center for Libertarian Studies in New York, which offices were on Union Square. I just actually walked by the offices the other day when I was in town on business, and it just brought back memories to that. Sure. Even the entryway to the office building brought back memories of the time I spent. I spent a lot of time in New York that I should have spent studying at Harvard Law School. And the Center for Libertarian Studies was a very interesting outfit. We had a journal, the Journal of Libertarian Studies. We had annual Libertarian Scholars Conferences. And that's when the theory of libertarianism really got debated. And to skip ahead to today, we can come back to this later, but one of the things that libertarianism has been lacking is an institutional structure in which its theory can be debated. That institute for the Center for Libertarian Studies, it ended up folding, and many of its personnel worked for the Institute for Humane Studies, but that was a different outfit, a different mission. And because over the last 50 years, there's been no intellectual infrastructure in which the theory of libertarianism could be debated and refined, it has been somewhat frozen in amber for 45 to 50 years, and no theory can survive being frozen in amber. It's not, and so I do think libertarianism as a theory needs to be refined and updated. But that's a whole different subject, and it'll also be the next book that I write. But I'm just saying that back then, we did develop the theory of libertarianism, and I wrote articles for the Journal of Libertarian Studies. I had them published there. But that has gone away. Now we have public policy think tanks who argue about policy, but they don't argue about first principles. Nobody does that anymore, and it really needs to be done again.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction, which a lot of times and I don't proffer to be any sort of philosopher or anything like that, but I do notice that a lot of times we go away from first principles. So at that time, I guess you mentioned Murray Rothbard. I guess if you were hanging out with the New York libertarians, you might have run into like Ayn Rand at that point, or perhaps Walter Block.
Walter and I were on the board together. Ayn Rand was anti-libertarian. People don't realize this. She hated the libertarians because she thought they were stealing her stuff. and perverting it. But I did, when I was in law school, did get to see Ayn Rand. She gave an annual lecture at the Ford Hall Forum in Boston. And in 1976, which was the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, she gave a lecture, which you can find on YouTube, about the Declaration. And I was there. I went to the Ford Hall Forum and I saw her perform or give her lecture. So that was my only connection with Rand.
It's funny because when I interviewed Walter Block, he kind of threw a line in there that I kind of took as a personality clash. But I guess in the way you've confirmed it, he said, he goes, Ayn was very nasty, you know, like to him on occasion. And from what you're saying, perhaps she had a resentment towards the up-and-coming libertarian thinkers of that period.
Yeah, she had sort of like a trademark to the objectivism was sort of a trademark thing. And if you were infringing upon that, you were infringing upon her property rights. But Murray Rothbard, who was in her circle, this is well known and it's discussed in a number of other books. Murray Rothbard was in her circle and ultimately got expelled from her circle. And part of the issue was Murray's wife, Joey, who I got to know quite well, was a practicing Catholic and Ayn was an atheist. And so Ayn was wanted Joey to convert to atheism. And it was something that she was not about to do and Murray was not about to make her do. And eventually that led to the separation of the two of them.
Right, right. No, that's very interesting. I wasn't aware of that little bit of a conflict there, but that's very interesting. When you get done with your academic career, you became a prosecutor, correct?
That's correct.
Initially. Was that something you had? Now, you mentioned the Defenders, which also I was not aware of. I consider myself a TV guy, having been raised by TV, but I had never actually heard of the Defenders as a show. So thank you for that little bit. I'll have to look that up. But did you always decide you were going to become a prosecutor, or was that the quickest way to employment, perhaps, after graduation? Or talk to me about becoming a prosecutor as opposed to, say, a defense attorney.
Right. Well, I always wanted to be a criminal lawyer for the reason that I said. And by the way, the Defenders never went into reruns, and so you don't get to see them. You can get the first season on a DVD collection. I have bootleg versions of the rest of the series. I've been rewatching them recently. They do hold up, although the first season is not as strong as subsequent seasons began. The episodes are hit or miss. Some of them are really good. Some of them are a little, you know, they also had a million guest stars. One of the theories as to why it's never been, why there's a rights problem with that is because there were so many prominent future stars that were guest stars that they have a hard time getting consent to have these things be redone. But at any rate, that was what sparked my imagination. I wanted to be a criminal lawyer, which is what I thought a real lawyer was. Everything else was not a real lawyer. I wanted to be a trial lawyer.
Right.
When I was in law school, and I started to see the difference between what a public defender would do, let's say, and what a prosecutor would do, I liked the prosecution side best because the defenders' ethical obligation is to zealously defend their client. The prosecutor's ethical obligation is to do justice, even if that means dropping charges against somebody who you believe to be not guilty or the evidence doesn't support a conviction. And I was more comfortable on the justice side, on the ability to do justice as opposed to represent a client. Also, you know, I'm kind of a law and order guy. I'm a law enforcement guy. I like law enforcement, and I enjoyed being on the side of law enforcement. And it was a fantastic way to get experience. And so the book that I have finished, but has not, I don't know when it's coming out, is called Felon in Review, Tales of True Crime and Corruption in Chicago, is the story of my days as a prosecutor, because lots was going on in the Circuit Court of Cook County at that time, which I tell in the book. So it was an extremely rich period of time to be a prosecutor, and I enjoyed it very much, got a lot out of it. And the skill set that I picked up there comes in handy all the time. I mean, I just got into a bit of a dispute renting a house and the owner did not want to give me back my full security deposit because they claimed there were damages, which we denied that we had anything to do with these damages. But immediately your instincts as a litigator, as a criminal lawyer, as a prosecutor kick in. And, you know, between yesterday and today they said, oh, don't worry, we'll cut you a check for the full amount.
Right.
All I did was make a few moves. They relented, which it also comes in handy as an academic as well, maneuvering faculty politics, let's say. Being able to try a case, being able to marshal your evidence is something that's a very important skill. So I value my days as a prosecutor, and when my next book comes out, everybody will see why.
Yeah, and the reason I asked is because, to your point, I've known a lot of both friends and family that upon graduating from law school, their typical first place of employment was always the DA's office, you know, like especially in a city as big as New York, you know, they're always hiring and everything. So I understand initially to say, hey, that's a great learning experience, even if I just stay there for 3-4 years, you know, and then move on. But I'm wondering if there's a seeming contradiction that if you're a libertarian, your first instinct might be to, and I appreciate your explanation of being interested in justice instead of vigorously defending your client. Is it seemingly contradictory, though, say, to the general public to say, I'm a libertarian, but I want to go into the employ of the state?
Well, libertarians believe in rights, and they believe rights can – libertarians are not pacifists. I mean, I suppose some are, but they shouldn't be. Right. Most libertarians are not pacifists. They believe in rights. They believe that rights violations should be against the law and that something should happen to people who violate rights. Now, the government has a monopoly on that function. Let's say that my lifelong dream was to carry mail before the rise of UPS and FedEx. Right. If that was my lifelong dream, I would have to go to work for the post office, even though they have a monopoly on letter carrying. And the same thing is true with being a prosecutor. If I wanted to be a public defender, I would have to work for the government as well. Right. So I don't think there's any contradiction there. I believe that there are good guys and bad guys based on how they behave, and the bad guys should get their just desserts. Which means something should happen as a result of committing crimes. But really, it should only be the guilty, not the innocent. And so one of the jobs I had as a prosecutor was try to weed out who was guilty and who was innocent. One of the jobs I held for 6 months or 9 months was on felony review. And felony review's job is solely to go to police stations, respond to calls by the police. In Chicago, no one can bring a felony charge without the approval of a state's attorney. So there has to be a Cook County state's attorney that passes off on this. And we approve basically 60% of our charges, and we disapprove 40%. We refused charges on 40%. In fact, in writing this book, I went through my logbook, and I could see that every week we would turn our logbooks in, and they would monitor our rate of approval and rejections to ensure that we were rejecting enough cases. And not just approving everything the cops wanted us to approve.
Yeah, you're reminding me of a little anecdote in my past, which is when I was called for jury duty once. I think it was the first time I got called for jury duty, and when the prosecutor was asking me questions, he asked something about how do I feel about the justice system, and what if you know the alleged offender was found, you know, you thought he was a guilty, and I said. Very naively, I said, well, if we're all interested in justice, the prosecutor should be just as happy to find out that this person is innocent. And I was immediately disqualified from jury duty.
So
I always thought that was hilarious. And by the way, if anybody wants to get out of jury duty in New York, use that as your answer. You don't have to go to any silly responses. Just say you're interested in justice, and they'll kick you right off the jury, which I always find hilarious, Professor. Okay, so you worked as a prosecutor. And then at some point in your career, you said, hey, I want to go into legal theory. I want to become a teacher of the law, a teacher of legal theory. Talk about that transition where you went away from being a prosecutor, although to your point, rooted in philosophical appreciation and desire for justice, and you kind of made this transition into academia and teaching, right?
Right. Well, when I went to write my book, A Life for Liberty, I recalled, my recollection was that the idea of becoming a law professor had occurred to me sometime during law school. But then I actually saved my applications for law school, and I see that in my applications to law school, I said that I think I wanted to be a law professor. But that was to teach the philosophy of law because I was a philosophy major. I was a very serious philosophy student. And so I thought that being a law professor would allow me to teach the philosophy of law. So I can see that I already had the idea going into law school of being an academic. What I But because of my background, nobody in my family had gone to college, much less to law school. I didn't know anything about what it took to become a law professor, and in fact, didn't do any of the things other than go to Harvard Law School. I didn't do any of the things, didn't acquire any of the credentials that law professors acquire, didn't get particularly good grades because I was too busy doing other things. I say that maybe I couldn't, no matter how much I would have dedicated myself to getting grades, I wouldn't have gotten any better grades. But I did, in fact, spend a lot of time in New York at the Center for Libertarian Studies doing other things. And so I really didn't have what it takes to be a law professor. And therefore, I had to go through the job market twice when I finally decided to do it, before I finally got my first teaching job, really not unreasonably, given my lack of credentials, the credentials right. that I didn't accumulate. On the other hand, there was also a bit of political bias because by that time I had published. And so my politics was my libertarian, which is coded right in academia, was well known, was discernible. And right. I know for a fact it was demonstrable. I mean, I know for a fact that I was discriminated against at several places because of my politics. I know because the people who were supporting me there told me that, including the chairs of the appointments committees at those schools. But nevertheless, I did get a teaching job and have been very successful and overcame that. And I'm very pleased to have done so. To directly answer your question, the appeal of being an academic is that when you're a lawyer and you're doing justice, you do justice on a retail basis, case by case. Very, very important. But what I wanted to do as a law professor was to do justice on a more global scale, on a more wholesale scale, to ask what is justice and advocate for improvements in our justice system, as well as improvements in our political order to ensure that our rights are protected, whether they're enumerated in the Constitution or not enumerated in the Constitution. And so being an academic for me is a means of advancing justice in sort of the bigger picture. And it's a division of labor. There's a lot of people that can try cases well. It's a very hard thing to do. Not everybody can do it, but there's a lot of people who can do that, but can't do what I do, which is legal theory, political theory, writing books, writing articles. And so in a division of labor, an Aristotelian would say, my highest value use is to do what I do best, and what I do better than other people, and that's be a legal theorist and commentator.
Right, well said. And I do agree with you. Like, people have perhaps this in back of their minds, they might say, well, if he was a good lawyer, it only makes sense that he'd be a good professor, and vice versa. And I think, to your point, those are not necessarily true, right? And to understand where your value is maximized is something that all of us should strive for, understand where we can have the greatest effect. You mentioned the bias, and interestingly, I don't think we'd be shocking anyone to say that universities have a leftward tilt, right, and have for a very long time, probably since the early 60s, right, since the Berkeley riots, say, right? But do you find – see, I've always been of the opinion, like, you know, libertarianism – I don't know why people associate it with the right necessarily. I understand if someone says, I refuse to be put in the left-right dogma, you know, I understand that part of it. But why do you think that it is that if you're a libertarian, the assumption in your case in the academic world is, oh, he's a right-winger, as opposed to saying he's neither left or right, and if we want to exclude him based on the fact that he doesn't fit into the left-right schism, then fair enough, but to automatically put you in with the lefty, with the right wingers seems to me to be something academics would avoid, right? Like, or is it more a matter of he's not one of the liberal tribe, therefore we don't want him here?
It's complicated, and it also has changed over time, but a lot of it is the latter. You're not part of their group. And they understand who's in and who's out, and you're not part of their group. That's a big part of it. There's also different strains of libertarianism, and this has happened over the last 10 or 15 years. And there are people who consider themselves left libertarians, and the truth is they are very much left libertarians. And a lot of people who just call themselves libertarians are actually kind of free market left wingers, and maybe not that much free market either. So there is a – and I would say that amongst the sort of intelligentsia of libertarians, the people that write for Reason magazine, or people that work, many of the people that work for the Cato Institute, let's say, I think many of them are more left-wing, and not, they like to say they're above it, but they're actually more left-wing. Now, I, on the other hand, will admit that I am a little more right-wing. I mean, I share a lot more in common with what is today considered the right. Now, I don't agree with everything that today is considered the right. And for example, I'm very thrilled by what's been happening in the Trump administration. And there are some old-fashioned establishment or movement conservatives that are kind of put off by what's happening, what Donald Trump is doing. I think a red-blooded libertarian should be ecstatic at what Trump and Musk are doing with the federal government that I thought would never happen in my lifetime. Now, that's my instinctive reaction. That puts me, I think that reaction puts me on the right more than it does put me on the left. And I'm very much opposed to progressives who are on the left. Whereas I do think many other libertarian intellectuals are really, many of them are really on the left. Nobody really knows about this, John. This is something, I'm revealing something about the movement that is really not, is really underappreciated even within the movement. But a lot of this breaks down as to whether you're a lawyer and a law professor or not. Many of the libertarian lawyers I know are like me. Glenn Reynolds at Instapundit, Eugene Volokh at now he's at Hoover. I mean, I could go through a list of law professors, Brad Smith, David Bernstein. I could go through a list of these law professors who generally lean right in their libertarianism, although we're not full-fledged conservatives. Whereas a lot of the people who are in the public policy realm in Cato or in the journalism realm at Reason, they tend to be a little more left libertarian. So that's kind of how it breaks down. It's a cultural thing, but it's not well recognized. It's going to be the subject of my next book on libertarianism. What pollsters do when they poll you and they say, are you a conservative, are you a Republican or a Democrat? And people say, no, I'm an independent. Then the next question, they say, do you lean Republican or do you lean Democrat? And then they put all the leaners in those buckets. There's no question I lean that way, even though I'm not a Republican. I am, in fact, an independent. I lean that way because I think nowadays, today, right now, right here and now, the two parties are not equal. The two sides are not equal. It used to be we could say, and I did say, that I agree with the Democrats about social issues. I agree with the Republicans about economic issues. The Democrats maybe the Republicans don't care enough about the economic issues. They say they do. I could say we could split the difference between the two. I don't think you can do that anymore, especially not as a Jew. You can't split the parties are not at a parity anymore. We have the Democratic Party that's been captured by the left, by its left, and squeezed out the liberals in that party so that they are marginal at best. The liberals like Alan Dershowitz, who is my professor at Harvard. And you have the Conservative Party. You have the Republican Party being more the Conservative Party, but also being a pretty establishment party. And now it's being challenged from within by MAGA and by the populists. I think actually in a healthy way. We can talk a lot more about that later. But anyway, it's complicated. And I think one of the nice things about being a libertarian is you don't have to be a member of either one of these tribes. You can look at them somewhat dispassionately. And even if you are leaning towards them one side or another at any given time, that could change depending on what they're going to be up to.
Right, right. You know, it's interesting because you kind of preempted my next question, which I'm very happy that you did, Professor. It shows, you're thinking ahead of me, which I'm humbled by. But actually, I was going to ask you, like, I've been tossing around the word libertarian, but I never bothered to ask you. Now, I have to freely admit, I stole this from Walter Block when I asked him the same question. His answer kind of resonated with me, which was when I asked him, like, when you say libertarian, I kind of assume you're an anarchist, Professor Block, but how do you describe it? And he said, I don't describe left and right. I happen to hold this belief. Apparently it's in opposition to what you just stated. I think the opposite. I think someone who describes themselves as a left libertarian or a right libertarian actually belongs to the right or the left, and they actually have picked off libertarian issues for themselves. The old hack line about some libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke weed type of thing, right? Whereas I kind of view it as, okay, you're either an anarchist, a minarchist, a constitutionalist, or a classical liberal. And in my mind, those are the delineations of the flavors of libertarianism that I think kind of encapsulate everything. So how do you feel about that? And from what I could tell, like, I don't think you would classify yourself an anarchist. Am I correct in that assumption?
Well, in my book, The Structure of Liberty, I defended a competitive legal order called a polycentric legal order. So that comes pretty close. So I think the answer to that is yeah, except okay. that I do think, and I'm going to talk about, I'm actually going to have a chapter about this in the next book. What anarchism is an ideal theory. It's a theory about what would work in the real world. What is the ideal system for the real world? And it's a claim, it's a theory, it could be wrong, that this theory of no states at all is actually the best outcome for the real world under certain circumstances which can be described. But it's an ideal theory. And we don't live in an ideal world. We don't live in that world. We live in the world of what economists and philosophers call second best. And in the second best world, we have 175 nation states. And in that world, where these governments exist, it is a mistake, and a naive mistake that many libertarians make, that what they need to do is import elements from the ideal theory and put them into the real world theory, even if it's just a piece. So the idea here is to move the real world in the direction of the ideal by taking any of the aspects of the ideal and plugging them into the current situation. Let me take the example of borders or immigration. If there's no government in the ideal world, then there should be no borders. In the ideal world, everybody should be able to move throughout the world the way we now can move throughout the United States. That would seem to be the ideal. We don't live in the ideal world. I mean, I'll grant that's the ideal. We don't live in the ideal world. We live in the real world of 175 nation states, some of which are tyrannical, some of which are not, some of which are in the middle, some of which are better, some of which are worse. You can pretty much tell which ones are the better ones by the ones that people want to go to, and which ones are the worse ones by the ones they want to flee, or they have to build a wall to keep their people out, to right. keep their people in. In a real world, if there's going to be better governments and better political systems, those political systems have a right to control who comes in and who goes out so as to preserve what makes them better. So in the real world, there's a reason to have borders. There's a reason to have immigration controls of various kinds. Even though I'm pro-free immigration, I'm not pro-open borders because I live in the real world where I can see that under conditions of open borders, we can lose what makes America, the United States, relatively more libertarian than other places around the world that people want to leave. So that's just one policy implication of viewing the difference between an ideal theory, which is what I think anarchists versus minarchists are debating, and that's an okay debate to have. I used to participate in that debate, and a real world theory, which is what moves us in a libertarian direction in a world of second best that has lots of features that perhaps are not ideal.
I wish I had several hours to talk with you, Professor, but just on this one example you gave, I'd like to refine it a little bit just to give me an understanding. So I understand the concept. Like, personally, I probably align with your position on this specific issue of immigration. I do align with it. Do you feel there's any danger, though, that if you don't keep your eye on the ideal, that then that position slowly degrades into a coercive one, or one that doesn't recognize that rights are by nature ours, right? The Lockean position, right? Like, are you afraid that if you don't keep your eye on that idealistic ball, so to speak, you're going to swing and miss, and it's very easy to degrade into the worst situation, not second best, but the worst situation where you do have people's rights being defined by borders and by governments, which I'm hoping we can agree should not be the case, right?
Well, I don't think there's any question you need the ideal in order to gauge what the real world is and where in the ultimate you want to go. The most important function of sort of the no state model or the anarchist model, I think, is to defeat the argument that would be made at any given time that any step in the direction of increased freedom will lead ultimately to no government. And in the world of no government, that would be just terrible. Now, if you question that assumption that the ideal state of no government is actually not terrible under right circumstances, then one step in the direction of more freedom, that no longer poses an objection or an obstacle to taking one step in the direction of more freedom. So it basically eliminates an argument which is a reductio ad absurdum argument. Reductio ad absurdum argument in philosophy is that if you do this, this proposition reduces to an absurd conclusion. It leads to an absurd conclusion. Well, if you question whether the conclusion really is absurd, you eliminate the reductio ad absurdum argument against doing what you're proposing to do today. So I think there's a function for ideal theory. I just think there's a naivete on the part of people who take ideal theory and want to import elements of it and think that the individual pieces of it will work without all the rest of it also being in place. That's the problem. You can't just pull one element out and put it into this world because it lacks all the other features that would make that world better. And it can't work here just in the alone, isolated from the rest of the system. But again, I think that's now more of an academic debate to have. And what we need to have now, I think the basic theory of libertarianism as it works in the real world, in fact, the subtitle of my book might actually end up being Libertarianism for the Real World, needs to modify some of these ideal world principles to accommodate the challenges and the reality of the world in which we find ourselves.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you for that answer. And this is one of those fun things that, you know, if you're sitting in a lounge somewhere having a scotch or whatever your beverage of preference is, you know, that you could talk several hours about these things. And I do think, there you go, Mountain Dew, and I have my coffee here, sir. So, yes. I do agree with you that those sort of discussions do need to continuously take place, even though, to your point, not just for the sake of having them, but how to implement them for what we have around us.
Exactly.
I've always told my anarchist friends, like, it's not that I object to your theory, by the way, but only if everybody else would agree to it. Like, if everybody else could agree to it in the world, then I am 100% behind you, but make some concessions to the fact that that's not the world we live in. And also, I'm reminded of something I just saw on X, I think Spike Cohen put out, and he says, someone asked him, I just became libertarian. What advice do you have for me? And he said, be prepared to make mortal enemies out of people who agree with 98% of what you just said. I thought that encapsulates the libertarians right now perfectly.
I think it encapsulates pretty much all ideologues. And I don't use ideologue in a negative or pejorative way, right. But I think it's pretty characteristic of that idea. The idea that Ayn Rand would cast out Murray Rothbard as an apostate, and Murray did his own share of casting out people from his circle as well. It sort of goes with the territory. I, on the other hand, tend to be ecumenical in my approach to theory. I'm an originalist. We're not going to have much time to talk about that in constitutional theory. But when I put on my Center for the Constitution, which I'm wearing our hat today, puts on our Originalism Summer Seminar, I make sure to include all kinds of different originalist theorists there to expose the students to the four or five different varieties of originalism that there are, so they can make up their own minds. I'm ecumenical when it comes to building a movement as opposed to sectarian, which I think is what actually ends up destroying these intellectual movements.
Right. And since you mentioned it, why don't you give us a brief summary? You are known as an originalist, very much so. Can you give, for the folks out there that are not familiar with the term, what is meant when someone says a Supreme Court justice, someone like a Scalia or someone like that, was an originalist? What is meant by that?
Right. Well, I'm going to give you a definition that sounds so obvious and commonsensical that you will not believe that this theory is actually controversial, which it is. And that is, originalism is the proposition that the meaning of the Constitution should remain the same until it's properly changed by amendment. The meaning of the Constitution should remain the same until it's properly changed by amendment. Now, what's there to disagree with? However, there's lots that people do disagree with, and whether or not Justice Scalia, who was one of the most vocal advocates on behalf of originalism, originalism wouldn't be where it is were it not for his advocacy. Whether or not he actually acted as an originalist all the time is a second question. Is an interesting question. The answer is he didn't, and nor do any of the other originalists. Other justices who identify as originalists, they identify as originalists, which is a great thing, and it means they are an originalist. They are originalists to some degree, but they are not always originalists. And by the way, just because you're an originalist doesn't mean you're right about your claim about what original meaning is. You could be wrong. I have changed my mind about what the original meaning of some clauses are, but most of the debate between originalists and non-originalists is really about not what the meaning of the Constitution is. That's an important debate, but how that meaning can best be enforced or applied, given that in many cases the meaning is at a very general or abstract level. It's not like a rule like says you have to be 35 to be president and every state gets two senators. Those are easy to apply. But how does the due process of law apply? How does equal protection of laws apply? What are the privileges or immunities of citizens? What are the rights retained by the people to which the Ninth Amendment refers? And then, if you can say what they are, how should they be protected? There's a lot of questions that are raised by trying to implement the meaning of the Constitution that should remain the same until it's properly changed by amendment. And that's what most of the debate is about, even within and amongst originalists, much less by people who question whether that's how you should go about doing it.
Right. And now help me, because, again, I'm not a lawyer, so forgive my ignorance as I ask you this, Professor. But is it part of the debate, even goes down to the actual physical words as written in the Constitution, right? So, for example, by hack example, the Second Amendment refers to a well-regulated militia. But the phrase well-regulated militia in 1783 meant something completely different than what we use well-regulated militia to mean, right? And if I'm not mistaken, well-regulated, that phrase meant trained, right? Well-trained, not regulated as in federally controlled, right? So the debate there is, even if you're sticking to the Constitution, are you sticking to the actual words and how the meaning of those words has evolved through time, or are you sticking to the meaning of the words when they were written, and those words themselves, the vocabulary, may have changed over time?
Right. There philosophers of language discuss the phenomenon called linguistic drift. And that is that individual word meanings can change over time. James Madison recognized this. This is one reason why he said he was an originalist. They didn't use that word. They didn't have that label because he says, you know, the meaning of words can change, and it'd be silly to think we're going to be bound by changed meanings of words that have changed. We're bound by the original meaning. He doesn't, again, didn't use that term, but that's right. The argument that he was making. So let's take the word dollars. Because there's you have a right to jury trial in disputes that are greater than $20 in the Constitution. Right. When the Constitution used the word dollars, what did they mean? Well, if you ask somebody today what you mean by a dollar, they would open up their wallet and show you a Federal Reserve note, a paper dollar. But of course, there were no such things as paper dollars. There was no Federal Reserve. There were no Federal Reserve notes back then. So what did they mean by dollar? Well, brief investigation will reveal. By the way, there were no United States dollars either at the time the Constitution was adopted. What there was the Spanish silver dollar. The dollar was the name for the Spanish coin. It was a coin that had a particular content of silver, and so a dollar was a measurement of silver as provided by the Spanish silver dollar. Immediately after founding the country, the United States started issuing dollars with the same amount of silver as the Spanish dollar had. That's what the word dollar meant. It didn't. So the word dollar in the Constitution refers to a particular unit of silver. The term domestic violence occurs in the Constitution. It gives the governor the right to demand, to request that the militia be called out to protect against domestic violence. Well, if you use the word domestic violence today, it means spouse abuse.
Right.
Does the Constitution allow the militia to be called out to protect, you know, husbands from being battered by their wives or vice versa? No, it's about riots in the streets.
Right.
So if you want to interpret the Constitution accurately, like if you wanted to interpret a letter that was written in the 18th century accurately, you would have to know what do the words mean when the person wrote the letter. What did the words mean when the founders wrote the letters of the Constitution? That's what it means. Now, is it binding? Should you follow it? How should you follow it? That's a second question after you figure out what the heck it means. Right. And those are very interesting questions, too. The claim about originalism makes two claims. The first is the meaning of the text of the Constitution is fixed when it's enacted. The second claim is that's a descriptive claim about how language works. Dollars meant dollars. Domestic violence meant domestic violence. The second claim it makes is normative. And that is we today, constitutional actors today, ought to follow and act consistently with the meaning of those words. That's a normative claim. The descriptive claim would have to be defended descriptively. This is how language works. The normative claim would have to be defended normatively. Here are the reasons why it's a good thing to act consistently with the meaning of these words. And then you have multiple arguments for why it's a good thing. But that's what constitutional theory provides for. That's what originalism theory, properly understood, provides for. We can't go into that today.
Right.
But that's a brief overview of what originalism is and the questions that it raises.
And to your point, it seems like such a logical position to stake out that one would almost have to ask, okay, what is the major opposition to that? Like, what would the group, I mean, I think I know the answer, but I'll ask you, what is the group that is most in opposition to the concept of originalism when it comes to constitutional law?
Those folks, and they're by far the majority of constitutional law professors, those folks have lots of arguments against originalism. But if you want to know what's motivating them is they don't actually like the original meaning of the text of the Constitution. They don't like it. They individually may have different reasons why they don't like it, what they don't like about it, but they don't like it. And so they have a lot of theories and arguments for why we shouldn't have to follow that. Some of them are, well, you don't even know what it means. You can't know what it means. It's impossible to know what it means. Some of them is it means terrible things and we shouldn't follow constitutions that say terrible things. There's lots of arguments, but they don't agree with it. When they do agree with it, by the way, and you'll see this happen all the time, they're the first ones to argue what the original meaning of the Constitution is. All the arguments, by the way, in favor of birthright citizenship being made by many, many non-originalists as well as originalists, too, both. But let's just talk about the non-originalists. They're happy to assert the original, what they claim to be the original meaning of the birthright citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment is, even though they're not originalists. Why? Because it's working for them. Right. And so they want to claim it. They're delighted to use the original meaning when it works for them. But when it doesn't work for them, then they have arguments for why we should just get away from it.
So they're just being practical to their political causes at that point.
Right. Ultimately, they view their political ends is what matters most, and they are in favor of pretty much any means to achieve their ends, whether that means following the Constitution, whether it means don't follow the Constitution, whatever it is. What's important is their ends.
Right. And Professor, I'm wary of your time that you've graciously given us, because otherwise I would have loved to talk about the two SCOTUS cases you argued, the Gonzalez versus Rage and the Obamacare case, National Federation of Independent Business versus Civilist, right? So we don't have time for that. But I will ask you, before we get to a little bit more about your book, I do have a part of this closing interview that I call silly questions. Now, these are just five questions that people get to know a little bit more about you. There's no right or wrong answer. So let's dive right into those. First question, you transitioned from being a criminal prosecutor to a libertarian legal theorist. What's the most surprising way your views on law enforcement have evolved as the result of that?
I'm not really sure how to answer that. I was very cynical about law enforcement before I became a prosecutor. I remained cynical. On the other hand, I'm for law enforcement, and I tend to like cops. And so I'm really not sure. I don't know that my views of law enforcement have really changed that much. I think I'm just as skeptical as I was, as I always have been.
Fair enough. Good answer. You portrayed a prosecutor in the 2010 science fiction feature film Inalienable. So let me ask you, who's more insufferable, a narcissistic actor or an activist judge?
I really enjoyed being with all these actors on set, and I came to respect them and their craft in a way that I never had as a movie fan, which is and TV fan like you are. I saw how hard they work, and I saw how skillfully they worked, and how difficult there was, you know, to do their job. I would never want to have their job, in part because I would never want to have the kind of insecure career that they have.
Right.
I think they both. On the other hand, you know, judges can. What kind of judge did you ask me about? What was the term?
An activist judge.
An activist judge. They can be pretty annoying as well. So it just goes to show anybody in any walk of life, in any occupation, can be annoying. You know, don't get me started on lawyers being annoying or law professors for that matter.
There you go. Fair enough. Okay. After a rough day at the office, what is your comfort food of choice?
I like everything my wife makes. Comfort food, though. I don't have a drink after work, so I'm not a drinker. I don't abstain, but right. Nor do I drink for that sort of effect. My comfort food, the thing that is my favorite thing, is ice cream. I just love ice cream.
Love ice cream. Any particular flavor?
A really, really good chocolate chip ice cream. You know,
fantastic.
Yeah, but I like, you know, I like Häagen-Dazs chocolate, Häagen-Dazs strawberry. I like Baskin-Robbins chocolate chip. But I think those are the
just an ice cream guy through and through.
I'm an ice cream guy.
Fair enough. What's a secret talent that has nothing to do with the law or libertarianism?
My secret talent. I'm at a loss.
Fair enough.
I just
you're an open book, Professor. There are no secret talents you have. Fair enough. And the final question: if you could create a mandatory course for law students that's completely unrelated to the law, what would it be?
But everything I would mandate for them would be related to the law. Although they would not, they'd be like philosophy of, you know. Political philosophy, moral philosophy, or history, American history. These are all things I think they should know more about, but they're related. They're not unrelated.
I think you've answered the question, though. When I wrote the question, I kind of meant like something that's not like tort law or something like that.
Yeah, you know.
But you've kind of answered it. Philosophy and history, they should have a solid grounding in that before they were to take your course. All right, Professor Randy Barnett, please hold up your book again, A Life for Liberty, The Making of an American Originalist. Thank you, sir. Please let the folks know where can they find the book and how can they follow you if they're so interested?
It's on Amazon, and an audio book is also available. I think it's 17 hours worth of audio you get for the audio book, and it's being professionally narrated. It's not done by me. I listen to it, and it's kind of a kick to hear my life story being told in the voice of someone else that's other than me.
Okay, fantastic. And do you have an X account people can follow you on?
I do.
Or an Instagram?
It's Randy E. Barnett. At Randy, middle initial E. Barnett. And I think I'm up to 45,000 followers now. But it can be a little edgy, I have to warn you.
Fair enough. Unlike everything else on X, we might find you to be a little bit edgy. All right, Professor Randy Barnett, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it. For everyone else, join us again for the next episode of The Big Questions with Big John, when I'll have somebody almost as interesting as Professor Barnett to interview. Until then, join us here on Grumblings Media for all your content needs.